Hey there, gang. Patrick King here, and I want to thank you for tuning in for episode number 9 of my new audio broadcast, Talking About Horses. In these broadcasts, I try to bring you some of the best riders, horsemen, trainers, equine advocates, and thought leaders in the horse industry for tips, insights, and stories. You can listen at home, at work, in the car, even in the saddle, either through Facebook, YouTube, or by downloading the podcast from the iTunes store. Today, I'm pleased to bring you a man known as one of the most effective and knowledgeable communicators in the horse industry today, a man who knows the microphone in this capacity much better than I do, Mr. Rick Lamb. Rick has been the voice of the Horse Show Radio, as well as the host of the popular RFD TV show, The Horse Show with Rick Lamb. He's been the voice of many commercial spots, as well as the host of the international competition, Road to the Horse. Rick, thank you so much for joining us. And did I miss anything in there?
Well, I don't know. I wasn't sure you were talking about me there for a moment. But hey, thanks. I really appreciate it. And I promise I'll do my best not to take over, okay?
Oh, perfect, perfect. And if you do, that's all right. I wouldn't mind taking a back seat, you know, and getting some tips from a pro in this. So Rick, so tell me, how did you first get involved with horses? And then we'll get to talking about, you know, your famous voice.
Oh boy. Well, you know, unlike a lot of kids who grew up around horses, I did not. I lived in a city, and, you know, maybe once a year I'd get to ride a horse or be around. I had a couple of relatives who had horses, and occasionally we'd see them there. But I was enamored with horses from a very young age, and really just never had a chance to do anything with it. And it wasn't until I was all grown up, you know, I was in my 40s, and I was just kind of sitting at the table one day, and I realized, hey, I could have horses now. You know, I'd gone through school, and I'd got a career going, and my family was in good shape. We had a nice house and stuff, and so I talked to my wife about it, and she was game. So we up and sold that house, bought a horse property, got some horses, and we were off to the races as horse owners. But the other thing was that I wanted to do something to kind of expand my business at the time, which was a recording studio. We did a lot of commercials. And so I decided to try a radio show, a syndicated radio show, about something, I didn't know what, and it was Diana again who suggested that we do it about horses. And so that's how the Horse Show got launched way back in 1997.
Wow, that's very cool. That's very cool. So you did, what sort of commercials were you doing in the recording studio?
Oh gosh, we did. We had most of the grocery stores in town would do their commercials. In fact, that's how I met Diana. She was the
really?
Official voice, yeah, of Safeway throughout all of Arizona. And every Friday for 5 years, she would come into my studio and we would record radio and TV commercials with her voice. And I was the guy, you know, behind the mixing console doing the tech part. And that's how we got to know one another. And so we did a lot of that kind of stuff. We did a lot of car dealership commercials, a lot of furniture stores. I mean, just about anything you hear on the radio and probably hate. that was the kind of stuff that we made our living doing. And, you know, I didn't always tell people. I was a little hesitant sometimes to tell people I made my living doing commercials because I didn't know if they'd hit me or something. But I liked it. And, you know, it was a pretty solid business. We had it for 31 years, and our studio was called Lamb Chops, believe
oh,
it or
nice.
Not, in Phoenix, and we got to be pretty well known. We had 4 studios and 2 locations, and I had 7 people working there at one time, and it was a good thing, and I loved doing it. But occasionally the phone didn't ring, and we needed a way to kind of diversify, and that's why we decided to get into radio.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And so you were pretty new horse owners at this time, and you decided to do a radio show on horses. How did that work out? I mean, well,
yeah.
We know how it worked out, but how did you, I don't know, how did you get the gumption to start it about something you were just new with?
Well, that's a very good question. And the reason that I felt that, you're absolutely right. I mean, I was as green as grass about horses. There was one thing I had going for me. I had a lot of enthusiasm. and about horses. I just loved the topic. And I realized that if I had experts come on my show, like I would have called in the early days, I would have called you and you would have come on and I would have picked your brain about horsemanship and horses and everything. And you got to be the star. I was kind of the facilitator, the host of the program. It was sort of like what Larry King has done all these years, you know, with his talk program on television. He doesn't have to be the expert on anything. He just has to be able to ask some good questions.
Right.
And I thought I could probably do that. And I knew that I could handle the audio side of it. If I pre-recorded the program, put it together in the studio and distributed it, back then it was on cassette, I wouldn't have to buy satellite time. I wouldn't have to be doing a live show, which was terrifying to me back then. But I thought that if I could do it on my own terms, it would probably be okay. And we had been doing a lot of work, just studio work, for the Farnham Company that's here in Phoenix as well. And, of course, they're the biggest advertiser in the horse industry. And I went to them and I said, would you guys have any interest in, you know, being my charter sponsor on this? And here's what I want to do, and here's a sample of how I would do it. And they signed up that very day, and the ball just started rolling. And by the time we actually had our first broadcast, which was April 19th of 1997, I had gotten 9 stations spread across 8 states to agree to carry the show on a barter basis, so I wasn't having to pay them to air it. And it just took off, and we never looked back.
Wow. That's fantastic. So you were able to use the show as an outlet to gain access for more knowledge for yourself then?
Oh, big time. I felt like I was the luckiest guy in the world because I had, you know, I could just ask a question that was on my mind. And I always looked at it this way. I thought if it's something that I'm curious about or don't know the answer to or is bothering me or troubling me with my own horse, chances are somebody else out there is in the same boat. And that was a pretty good rule of thumb. So I never hesitated to ask a question, no matter how dumb it was. And that really worked. And my knowledge kept growing as a result of that. And of course, through my own experience with my own horses, I got horses myself after that. So I was kind of balancing that intellectual learning with, you know, the hands-on learning. Mm-hmm. And that's how my particular journey took shape.
That's pretty fascinating. I love it. I love it. And that's, I won't lie, that's kind of one of the reasons that I started this audio broadcast, is so that I could talk to more folks and in a big way be able to connect with a lot of my horseman friends and trainer friends and rider friends that go around the country that we never get to catch up with because we're always crossing paths, you know, traveling around clinic to clinic and things like that. So that's pretty fascinating. I didn't know that about how you had started the show. That's very cool.
Yeah. So and the reality is every person out there who is a horse or I say most everybody that's out there needs publicity. They need the promotion. It helps for them to get out in front of the public. So it was a win-win thing. I needed content for my show, and I wanted to learn. And they wanted access to my audience. So we never ran into a problem with getting people to come on our show. And I met people that way that I never would have met in a million years if I hadn't had a radio show.
Right, right. Well, and I know how I was very surprised when I told you a little bit before we came online here that when I discovered the capability of doing this, I sent out the same night I discovered that I could do this, I sent out probably, 100 messages saying, hey, would you be interested in joining me for this? I had no idea how I was going to get it started at that point. But kind of like you with the radio show, it was the enthusiasm. The tail started wagging the dog. And within 24 hours, I had enough people agreeing for about a year and a half worth of episodes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and you know, it gives you an opportunity to kind of jump into areas or disciplines or sports that you haven't had any personal experience with and learn a little bit about them and kind of try and draw out the parallels to, you know, riding and horsemanship in general. And I think people like that. I think the connecting the dots is one of the things that I've always tried to do. And, you know, there's a lot of dots out there, and there's a lot of new people coming into this.
Yes.
You know, every single show that I put out, I figured there's going to be somebody listening to it who's just like me when I was in the very beginning and I didn't know anything. And I try to be careful about terminology to make sure that if I was going to use a term, kind of an insider term or a term that was very common among horsemen, but it might not be known by the general public, I made sure that I always defined what we were talking about. Gotcha. So, you know, we didn't have a lot of jargon floating around, and that seemed to help too.
I'm sure. I'm sure. Wow. So now, how long did you have the radio show before you went with the TV show, and what was the big idea for the TV show?
Well, to answer your question, we started in 97 on radio, and a few years into that, in 2003, I got the opportunity to host Clinton Anderson's tour around the country. He called it the Walkabout Tour. I think he still does it. Mm-hmm. And I did that for 4 years, and that got me exposure to a lot of people, a lot of big audiences at a live event. And Clinton had a TV show by that time, so he asked me to come on and host a live call-in show. We did that twice on RFD TV.
Okay.
In addition to his regular weekly produced show. And so that kind of introduced me to the people there, and they saw me, they saw what I could do. But the main reason that I went into television was that the radio show, this is going to sound a little boisterous, it's not meant to. The fact that the radio show had gotten completely full of sponsors. I couldn't take anybody else. We were completely full up.
Wow.
And I had somebody come to me and say, we'd really like to advertise with you. And I said, I'd love for you to, but I don't have anything to give you. And so when that happened, I talked to the gentleman. It just kind of came to me, well, maybe we could just spill this over into TV and do something similar to what we've done on radio. So I ran the idea by him. He loved it. I talked to a few other of my sponsors that had been with us on radio. They liked it, and we just jumped in with both feet onto TV, and that was 2006, and TV ran all the way until last July.
Wow.
And that was a good run for us too.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. So how many TV episodes did you have in total?
Oh gosh. I'm gonna guess we're in the 300 range, 300 individual shows. You know, there were some seasons where we reran things that we had done in the past, or we repurposed them. We added new content. We used, you know, certain interview segments or whatever. So it gets a little complicated figuring it out, because mm-hmm. we didn't do a brand new show every single week. And we also had the regular rerun cycle. We would do 13 new shows. Then those 13 would rerun, then 13 and 13. That's how the year went.
Okay.
So I would guess a safe number is probably in the 300 range.
Wow, that's quite a few.
Yeah.
Well, I know, I'll admit that back whenever I was watching TV, yours was one of my favorite shows on there. And I particularly remember liking the show that you did on Professor James Beery.
Jesse Beery.
And it was fantastic, because as you were talking about that, I had an entire original set. I think there was two different sets, and I had both of the sets, the entire complete original sets.
The little blue booklet?
Yep, the little blue booklets, and then there was some that were little yellow booklets, too.
Yeah, that was on the saddle horse. I think that series was on the saddle horse,
yes.
And the blue ones were on horsemanship.
Yeah.
And you know, you had asked me before we did this if I had any favorite shows, and that was one I was going to mention.
Oh, really?
And that happened actually within the first year we were on television. One of the things that I wanted to do with TV is I wanted to do historical pieces, kind of like back then what the History Channel on TV does.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
Finished a bit since then, but in the beginning they were just really kind of nice, serious historical pieces, and there were so many interesting horsemen of the past that I had kind of dug out some information about when I did The Revolution in Horsemanship with Dr. Miller, the book that we did.
Okay.
And a big part of that was tying modern horsemanship to horsemanship of the past and seeing where there were differences and where there were similarities and all of that. And so Jesse Beery was somebody that I had discovered back then, and I thought this would be fantastic if we could do a TV show about that. So I looked into it. I actually made contact with his family. And
they were on the episode, weren't they? They were on the episode.
Yeah. They were on the episode. They had a family reunion they put together in Pleasant Hill, Ohio, just for the purpose of facilitating me learning about their great-grandpa or grandpa or whatever it happened to be.
Oh, wow.
And you see that in the show, all of these really nice folks. And they brought all of the mementos, you know, that they had of his stuff. He had a very long career as an educator, mm-hmm. and he was one of the original people to embrace distance education, because he started this correspondence school of horsemanship, he called it. And that's what those little blue booklets were used for. So there were just tons of original materials there from that, and some of his appliances, as he called them. He had a particular bit he liked to use, mm-hmm. and just a variety of other things. So that was one of my favorites. And we weren't big on entering things in contests, but we did enter that one in a couple different contests. We won 4 awards on it.
Nice.
So, so you picked a good one to mention that.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I remember also in the booklets he had, what did he call it? The noise machine or something like that. Did you happen to get a chance to see one of those there?
Noise, but no, I don't know what that is.
Okay. It was interesting. It looked like a jack in the box or something, and it must
He would crank it and it would make a clattering noise. You're absolutely right. I showed a picture of that. I didn't talk specifically about it. Yeah, he was very big on desensitizing horses.
Yes.
And you know, it was about 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago, when he was at his peak. And something that came out in that show, and I tried to make the point, some people got it, some people didn't, is that the time that he lived, horses were absolutely crucial to everyday life. Everybody had some contact with horses.
Right.
And so, especially driving horses. He was very big on training driving horses. So you couldn't mess around. It wasn't just a recreational activity. It wasn't something you could take lightly. Everybody had to have a horse that they could depend on. So that made the training all the more important. And, you know, in some cases, it was a little bit more direct,
yes,
would be a kind way to put it.
Because mm-hmm.
People look back, some people would comment on that and say, oh, he was cruel and there's, you know, much kinder ways today. First of all, I don't think that's true. But secondly, one of the things I said in that episode is if he were alive today, he would probably be doing things differently.
Right.
Because context matters.
That is so true. Context matters. Man, that's a line I tell my students all the time when they ask questions. How do I fix this or how do I fix that? Context matters.
It depends.
So
yeah.
And there are, you know, I remember reading at the booklets at the time and thinking, wow, some of those things sure seem rather archaic. But it's exactly like you said. You know, if there were horses in those times when it was almost strictly a utilitarian purpose for the horse, if there was a horse that needed his help, it probably needed serious help. And for survival's sake, it needed to just be done and be solid.
Yeah, absolutely. And Professor Beery followed on kind of in the tradition of another American horse tamer that was back around the time of the Civil War named John Rarey.
Yes.
He's the guy that was mentioned in the beginning of the Horse Whisperer book,
mm-hmm.
and was the guy they sort of allude to as being the old time horse whisperer. But he was a superstar at the time of the American Civil War. And his techniques were similar in that he would be working almost exclusively with rogue horses, in some cases what they call man killers, really troubled horses who were, you know, one had one foot in the grave, you know, in the slaughterhouse. And if he couldn't fix them, that's where they were going.
Right.
And so he had some pretty, what looked to modern eyes, severe techniques. The one that was at the heart of it was laying the horse down. And but it was something that made a profound change in the attitude of the horse. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever done that. Oh, there's a lot of modern horsemen who use it as a trust building exercise. Sure. As opposed to, you know, dealing with a really, really troubled horse. But either way, it produces a change mentally with the horse. And Rary died in about 1868, I believe it was. And there was, it left this void, because he was like the acknowledged superstar horse trainer, not only in America, but also in Great Britain. And then there was this rush of all these other horse trainers back then to fill that void and become the next Rary. In fact, that was the term they would use. This guy's the next Rary or whatever.
Really?
And And that's the climate in which Professor Beery got started as a young man, going around kind of itinerant almost, helping people with the really troubled horses. And then he decided that he needed to be a home more for his family, and that's when he decided to build a school and develop this correspondence course. So very interesting character.
Fascinating, fascinating. And it's very interesting how that still kind of follows the line of a lot of horsemen today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they hit the road, and then if they can, they build their own place and have people come to them.
Right, right. That's awesome. That's fantastic. So, I mean, I'm just loving the fact that you've got all these stories from all the experience that you've got talking with all of these people, and from some of the shows that I've watched, and I won't lie, I haven't watched all your shows. I hope you won't take that personal. But I've watched quite a few of them, though, I will admit, quite a few. But it seems to me you've chatted with some of the world's best horsemen, thought leaders, nutritionists, all of those things. Aside from the Jesse Beery show, which I love that was one of your tops. I love that. That's fascinating. Are there any others that stand out as really kind of great shows in your mind, or even the ones that maybe you didn't think were the best of your shows, but super meaningful for you?
Well, my personal favorite was the historical stuff. I really kind of sunk my teeth into that. And I did one on Monty Foreman that of people appreciated.
I remember that one also, yes.
Because he was a guy that really was ahead of his time. You talk about a thought leader. He was way ahead in the thinking, and especially about riding. And when I decided to do this TV show about him, I felt that there was a danger that he was going to be forgotten and the information would be lost. There was a book that he and Patrick Wise had written called Horse Training Science, but that was a big, thick, kind of imposing book, and I didn't think too many people would read that. There was some old film available on DVDs that was just unedited, and things that he had made that he used in his teaching that was very, very cool, but it was just raw material and nobody could sort it out. Mm. So I was determined that I was going to be the one that did that, that kind of documented this. And so I got a hold of Ron McLaughlin, who was one of his certified trainers that's here in Arizona. Patrick Wise helped me, and the lady who Johanna Fallis, who she and her husband were in the saddle making business with Monty.
Oh, yes,
and developed
the
balanced ride saddle that was so revolutionary. Mm-hmm. She agreed to be on the show, and actually Monty's son Gary was still living at the time, and I did a radio interview with him, and I pulled excerpts of that on into the TV show. So the other thing about being connected to Gary and the family is he sent me everything that they had collected about Monty. I mean, a whole big box the size of a file box.
Oh, wow.
Full of flyers and photographs and things about his career, things that I've never seen before, aren't captured anywhere else. And so I was able to present a fuller picture maybe than anybody had done before of Monty.
Wow. So and you had the personal family file box for that. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was a pretty important thing to me, because I felt like I did something to keep his memory alive. And so that was an important one. Another one that was big, kind of for the same reason, was about this horse that was in the Korean War called Sergeant Reckless, who took ammunition from down at the bottom of the hill up to a battery on top of the hill where these great big guns would shoot these huge bullets in the Korean War. And she did that through firefights, completely at liberty, up and down the hill, bringing back dead Marines on her way back, get another load of ammunition, would take it up to the top of the hill. It's just a phenomenal story, and I'm getting chills just even telling you this little bit about it. Yeah. But that is probably my all-time favorite show that we've done.
I'm going to have to look that one up for sure.
Yeah, Sergeant Reckless. And there's some other stuff out there as well, but my program, it kind of included some of the other material that was already available at the time. So that was one. We did another one on, Gene Autry and his, all the horses that played champion in his life.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and on the Pony Express, and we did one on cattle drives. And so those were kind of the historical ones that I liked. And then the other format that we used, which was very popular as well, and again, it was part of my learning curve, was me learning how to do something that I couldn't do before on a horse.
Okay.
And we would have an expert show me, and you would see the whole process, you know, warts and all. And the very first TV episode we did was me getting a cutting lesson from Al Dunning. And I had never even sat on a cutting horse. Well, he put me on a little gray Starlight mare that was pretty catty. I lost my seat more than once in that, and at one point I almost came off the horse when she zigged and took off at a canter, and I zagged and fell off to the side, and you can hear Al in the background, "Get back in the saddle, Rick. Pull on the horse. Don't fall off."
Get back up there, man. You're on camera.
yeah. So, you know, you had asked me at one point about embarrassing moments. Yeah. That was our very first TV show, and we had this footage that where this happened, and I thought it was hilarious, but I didn't know how the audience would feel, if that would diminish me in their eyes, if I would lose all credibility because I couldn't ride a cutting horse better than that. And we decided to go ahead and use it in the show or put the credit roll at the very end of the show over that footage and just see what happened. And all people loved that.
I'll bet they did.
And I got ribbed about that for years, and it was always a great icebreaker. Somebody comes, "I saw that show where you just came off that cutting horse." Yep. And so that kind of became a little signature thing on TV, where at the end of the show you would see outtakes. And it was never intentional, but in shooting any show like that, there's going to be times when I got tongue-tied, or I did something wrong, or we had a funny interaction between Diana, who was running the camera, and me, or the guest. And that became something people looked forward to. In fact, one of my back burner projects is to go through and pull all of those outtakes together and make a little, blooper type DVD and put it on YouTube so people can kind of see them all together.
I'll bet that would be great. That would be great. So folks can find all of your episodes on YouTube, is that correct?
Well, not all of them, but a lot of them.
Okay.
You just look up The Horse Show with Rick Lamb, and a lot of them are on there. I've been slowly going back and taking the commercials out and putting them back on both YouTube and Facebook without commercials, since those sponsorships are long gone. But there are versions there that have been there for years that do have commercials in them. If you can kind of just stomach watching commercials along with the content, there's a whole lot there.
Right. And now some of your radio shows are on YouTube also as podcast style. Is that right?
Yeah. What I found out was, I mean, this was something we struggled with from the very beginning. How do we get, having it on a terrestrial radio station was great, but the chances of a particular individual I met out at a horse expo being able to hear that show on a station that was close to him or her was almost nil. I mean, if somebody wanted to hear my show, there was no way that I could ensure that a station near them would carry it. So we, from the very early days, wanted to get it online, have it some kind of streaming format. But way back in the 90s, I mean, they were still kind of working this all out as to how to do that. And it was different on Macs versus PCs, and you had to have a particular player to do it, and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
So once YouTube got firmly established, I realized YouTube is the universal platform. And I can put my audio programs on there, but it's for video. So you have to have some kind of an image along with it. So I ended up just putting my picture and the name of the radio show and the title, you know, of who it is on that. And so when you go to YouTube and you look for my radio programs, that's, they'll play as if they're video, but there's really nothing to look at. It's you just listen to them.
Right.
But
right.
The great thing about YouTube is it's available on every device and every platform. And so yes, it really made them accessible.
Absolutely. I know there's been multiple times where you've helped me, you know, paint a room in a house or build a deck or something like that, because those were great for being able to just turn them on. I add a little speaker to my phone and could have you streaming while I was doing other things. So that was great. And that's
cool.
How I've been able to listen to a lot of what you had done. So
Yeah. Well, that's the idea.
Yeah. So when you started the TV show, did you just phase out cold turkey of the radio show, or were you doing both back to back?
No, it continued, and what we found out was that once people knew that they could be on television, they lost interest in radio. So we kept it going, but we couldn't really sell sponsorships as easily as we had once, because now people knew that they could be on TV.
Gotcha.
So what we ended up doing after a while was, and it was something that I think we were the only ones at the time could offer, was that if somebody, a company, bought a sponsorship on our TV show, we would include at no extra cost the same thing on radio. So they basically got radio and TV for the cost of just TV.
Okay.
And that was good for us, because that, and we could plug that as something unique that we had to offer, that we were in both media. And we continue doing that. In fact, the radio show is still on, believe it or not. We're in kind of a transition period where we're going to a subscription model with stations. So we're going to lose, I'm sure, a lot of them that were carrying it as a barter program. But it will still be out there in some parts of the country as long as stations want it and people want to listen to it.
Awesome. And now, are those new shows or those past shows?
Those are typically past shows.
Okay.
And it takes about, but I've got about 3.5 or 4 years worth of programs before anything recycles. So chances are that somebody tuning in has not heard whatever it is that they're listening to that day.
Right, right. Wow, very cool. So so you did about 300 of the shows on TV. What spurred you to a stop on that? What fueled the fading out of that?
Well, I can't go into that too deeply. We were not getting along very well with the network.
Oh, okay.
I was seeing some changes in the way that, you know, the sponsor base out there was looking at television, broadcast television. What was becoming exciting for them and is really kind of the thing that I'm more immersed in today is social media.
Yes.
Facebook in particular.
Right.
And this is a good example. This is, I mean, this platform is like nothing we've ever seen before for reaching people. So that's where I went, and I had gone back to school and gotten some education about micro-learning and learning with media, and found that I'd already done some experimenting with that on my TV show, where you would see very short, like 2-minute segments in my show week after week. They were part of a series on nutrition or
writing maneuvers
or whatever.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was an example of micro learning. And I started doing that before I even knew there was such a thing, or there was a term, or it was a thing out there. But it is very well established now, and we understand why they, you know, these short learning videos work so well. And that's kind of what I'm specializing in now.
Wow. Very cool. So tell us some more about the micro learning, because that sounds intriguing. I remember seeing, like you're talking about, the little 2-minute
sure.
clips So well, what's that all about?
Well, first of all, you have to kind of release the idea that more is better when it comes to content. More is usually not better. More is usually going to work against you. So when you see somebody who's trying to promote the, you know, a training video or something, and they say 6 hours of instruction or something, that doesn't really turn people on. I mean, that seems pretty intimidating. People want, especially the younger generation coming up, but everybody wants something shorter if they can get the same value out of it as compared to something longer. And I'll give you an example. If you needed to learn how to, wanted to teach yourself how to patch a hole in drywall or something, you would go to YouTube and you would look up patch drywall. And if there were two videos there and one was 2 minutes and one was 30 minutes, which one would you watch first?
Right, exactly. You're
You'd
so
probably
right.
watch the two-minute one because you figure there's a chance that I can get the same thing in 2 minutes that it would take me 30 minutes to get. And so people are drawn to learning faster if the quality is there. And what I've learned through school and through experimenting is that there are ways that you can layer information in media, for instance, audio, you know, sound and picture together. The brain can process those at the same time. It doesn't overwhelm the audio channel. Just have a picture also coming because that comes in a different, you know, sensory channel in the brain. And so in a sense, you can kind of mentally multitask when you're using multiple media. And the same is true with words and pictures. They are not processed in the same part of the brain, so they can kind of be processed simultaneously. So if you can put all this together and have, especially if there's kind of a story thread through it, because people really respond to stories.
Yes.
Then you're golden, because you're going to hook them, you're going to hold them, and they are more likely to retain that information than with any other format that we know of.
That's interesting, and the story factor would really help with the retention.
Absolutely. And, you know, everybody's got a story. And, you know, the fact that social, in fact, the people that are listening to this right now are interested in my story.
Yes.
Yeah, they might think that they might learn something at the same time, but that's probably not their primary motive. They might be a little curious or whatever it may be. But story is a vehicle. And when you see the buzz in the advertising and marketing circles, it's all about story. In fact, it's almost with a capital S.
It's
that important in crafting a message that you want to get to somebody, whether it's to serve your own, you know, marketing purposes, or whether you're trying to help them learn something.
That is so true. And there's, I know, as I said, I watch extremely limited TV, usually only in passing through a hotel and things like that, but I've seen enough commercials where there are some commercials that you just want to shut the TV off for somebody. You know, it's just buy this, buy this, buy this. And then there are others that really kind of get you hooked, and those tend to always be the ones with the stories.
Yeah. Well, the example probably that it really drives this home, you may be too young to remember this, but back, and I think it was about in 2001, there was this commercial for Macintosh that happened on the Super Bowl broadcast. And it was kind of a you know, super, kind of, you know, space odyssey kind of a thing, a futuristic scenario where there's Big Brother and there's a bunch of people looking all the same. And it was kind of a vision of what some of the futurists thought it was going to be like in the future for humankind. Mm. And a runner comes in and throws a sledgehammer and breaks this giant screen where, you know, the Mighty Oz or whoever the person was, Big Brother, was looking down on them. And that was symbolic of Macintosh kind of changing the whole game as far as computing was concerned. And that was the most talked about commercial, maybe of all time, and one of the more costly ones up to that point, and it aired one time.
Wow.
on the Super Bowl. So that's a great example of creating a story and engaging people, drawing people in, and leaving them with a message that they just can't shake.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Fascinating. So with the micro learning, like you said, you had experienced these with nutrition and that sort of thing in your shows. How are you using that now?
Well, some of those same sponsors who I did those for on television, I'm still doing work for them outside of broadcasting because they all have an ongoing need for media. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing that's absolutely certain now is that people prefer video over text and even over still photographs. Yeah. And we can see that. We know that from the statistics from Facebook, for instance. Mm-hmm. And Facebook is becoming more and more video oriented. So content, there's a constant need to be generating new video content, whether it's for entertainment or whether it's for messaging or advertising, whatever it may be. Major brands need to be constantly generating that. And in shorter and shorter lengths, we're even getting to the point, I'm doing a series now that are 15 seconds long.
Really?
And
wow.
So, yeah, so that's kind of an example of extreme micro-learning.
That sounds like my kind of education.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you something funny, Patrick, is the reason that this isn't just this is supported by research. Microsoft did a study in 2014 up in Canada to try and determine what the attention span of the millennial viewer, typical millennial viewer, was. And they determined that it was 8 seconds. 8 seconds before.
Wow.
That's all the time you've got before they start getting bored. Now, the interesting thing is that they had already determined that the attention span of a goldfish was 9 seconds. So so this is what's driving everything. You know, your typical viewer, and this isn't to put them down, it's just the reality of it, has a shorter attention span than a goldfish. So you really have to craft a message carefully to get
right.
it to them and grab them and hold on to them, hopefully to the end of your message, but at least long enough to get the message out there. So
yeah.
When we're doing these 15-second things, I'm making sure that I make the key takeaway within the first 8 seconds. I figure I might have them for 8 seconds. I don't know if I'll have them all the way to 15 seconds. And then it's getting crazy, too, because some of the big major advertisers, the Procter & Gambles and so forth, are experimenting with 6-second ads on Facebook. So you will probably start seeing some of those. I mean, that's like a couple blinks of the eye and it's gone.
Yeah.
And I think they've kind of reached the point. Probably they've pushed it too far. I think they're going to say, okay, we can't quite get anything done in 6 seconds.
Right.
But the 15-second, you can really do something there.
Wow. That's fascinating. I know I've been experimenting even with some of the videos that I do, because I do on my channel, I call them my almost daily live question and answer videos, where folks will submit questions and I just pick a random question and give an answer in video. And there are some videos that I get into for 10, 15, 20 minutes. And then there are some that are simply 3-minute videos. And I've always wondered why some of them will get more attention than others. But even the longer videos, I found some of the longer videos might get more attention, but it makes sense for what you're saying. There's something serious in there that's grabbing the viewer's interest,
yeah.
And that's what's keeping them in.
Here's the other variable, too, and we know this from the research that's been done in kind of the academic world, is that if somebody is more knowledgeable about the subject, they can handle longer lessons and more
gotcha.
In-depth.
Yep.
So if you've got an audience that's very tuned into what you're doing and very sophisticated, it's not as critical that you break it down into these tiny nuggets. That's really ideal for an audience that's pretty new to the subject matter.
Gotcha.
And in fact, what they found is that people that have a lot of prior knowledge in the subject don't like it as broken up because they, it's hard to kind of get a rhythm going with them. If they really understand what's happening and they're into it, they don't want to take a break every couple minutes. But, you know, the vast number of people that are new to a subject or are hearing a message for the first time, they don't fit in that category. So it really varies depending on the learner or what the audience, their prior knowledge is as to whether that's going to be most effective.
Interesting. So if we were considering developing an educational program, then we would want to take that into account. And for the beginner learners, for the early learners, we'd want to have shorter bite-sized pieces and then potentially build in length as we go along, huh?
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And the other thing about it is when you think of a little tiny short nugget of learning media, you can't think of it as living by itself. It's just one of dozens, maybe, of it, brothers and sisters, if you will,
sure,
that are on the same subject. It's just that you've taken, and all together, they cover a big topic, but it's just been broken down into little tiny bite-sized pieces. And in that sense, it's kind of like what you do with a horse when you, you've got a big lesson you want to learn, teach him. You break it into little tiny pieces so that he can absorb it and give him a break between each one.
Right.
So that he can kind of catch up with his mental processing. And the same is true with human learning, is you get a lot coming in and then you need some time to kind of process it before you take more in.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That makes so much sense. Very interesting. That's fascinating that you're getting more into that. So what are the industries that you're doing this for? Is this just for the horse industry that you're creating these little micro learning videos, or?
Well, the good news about it for me is that the principles of doing this are independent of the particular subject matter that you apply them to. So it could be anything. It could be any field. But as a practical matter, I've only been doing this for a few months since my TV show stopped. And I've just been going with I've had enough work to keep me busy just within the horse industry. And the good thing there, as much as I can do that, I want to. For one thing, I like the people. I like the subject matter. Mm-hmm. But I've also picked up a lot over the years. So even though I'm not the primary subject matter expert, and there's always going to be other people that are reviewing it and making sure that it's accurate, I have enough expertise in, like, equine nutrition, for example, that it just speeds the whole process up a whole lot more.
Gotcha.
If I knew nothing about it, I would have to work much more closely with a subject matter expert, and it would take longer, and it would be, and involve more people's time and therefore be more expensive.
Right. That's fascinating to me. You got my wheels turning in there now too. I can't wait to see how all this stuff unfolds. That's fantastic. That's very cool.
Well, the other thing too, from just a personal standpoint, is, you know, when one of the things I liked about working on commercials all those years is that it was a job that had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and I could wrap it up, get closure, if you will, on it, and move on to the next project. And I think as a human, we need that sense of tying up loose ends before we start something else. Before I had my recording studio and was self-employed, I was a computer programmer for a number of years, and there were projects that I worked on where more than a year, the same project, and every day was like the day before or the day after.
Sure.
And it was just kind of this plodding towards this kind of vague goal out there that I didn't know if I would even be around when it got finished.
Right.
And that wasn't nearly as satisfying to me as taking a small job, doing it well, wrapping it up, taking some pride in it, catching my breath, and then starting something new.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that would surely keep the motivation for the project as you went also.
Sure, absolutely.
Even if it was a larger project being broken down.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, you know, speaking of which, we've nearly been chatting for an hour already. The time frame on these goes by so fast. Speaking of wrapping things up, I love how we inadvertently went into that segue there. I would love to pick your brain for a few wrap-up questions here. This has been
sure.
so much fun for me. I love this. I'm so glad, again, that you agreed to come on the show with me here.
Well, thank you.
But so let's see. So if there was, based on all of the horsemen that you've ridden with and that you've chatted with and that you've got to experience through the years now, if there was one specific thing that you could recommend for riders to focus on as a primary means of improving their horsemanship, or we'll even go with communication because I think that's very fitting, what do you think that would be?
Well, the thing that I always start when I talk about the idea of natural horsemanship is I ask people to not look at the word natural, but at the core word nature. Mm-hmm. And it's horsemanship that is based on the nature of the horse as a unique animal species. And I would say that any horseman's journey has to begin with making a study of this unique animal species, what makes it tick, its history on the planet, its herd psychology, the physiology, the nutrition, all that kind of stuff figure into it. Before we start asking a horse to do something for us, we have to understand what's important to him. So I would say that that is the very beginning of the horseman's journey.
I totally agree. That's completely the core of horsemanship. That's fantastic. All right. If you could ride with anyone past or present, who would it be and why?
Well, I'm fascinated with Tom Dorrance because he is just almost bigger than life now in this whole natural horsemanship movement. I never met him. I talked to his wife once on the phone. I met Ray Hunt once, but didn't really get to talk to him too much. And I guess I would like to just form my own opinion of the man and hear what he said and how he said it and when he said it, and see if it seemed as profound coming out of his mouth as it does when everybody else talks about it.
Yes,
because
right, when it's passed
down. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know people that did, and I'm so envious of them for having done that.
Right.
And he was just such a he apparently was such a sweet, gentle man and brilliant in his own way, but the little prescriptions, I call them, that he and Ray Hunt left us are just absolutely golden, in my opinion.
Yes.
For anybody trying to break it down, you talk about breaking something down to the essence,
right.
Little nuggets.
Absolutely.
I mean, gentle as possible, firm as necessary, that kind of thing. Just fantastic. So
yeah.
I'd probably say him.
Oh, I love it. I love it. He would definitely be on my list. There was one of my favorite stories of Tom comes from my friend Craig Johnson, the Rainer. He went and rode with, I believe it was the last clinic that Tom taught, the last public clinic, and he had a problem with his horse with a turnaround, and he was asking Tom about it, and it was a situation, and I'll probably, you know, bung up the story here trying to share it, but the gist of it was he was trying to figure out if the front end of the horse was causing the problem in the turnaround or if the back end of the horse was causing the problem. And Tom's answer to him was, have you ever looked at one of those pictures that's just a bunch of blue spots, and the longer you look at it, you see a sailboat pop out? And that was Tom's answer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess he asked the same question of Ray Hunt, who I have had the good fortune of riding with. I actually got the chance to live with Ray for a couple months. It was fantastic. But he asked Ray the same question, and Ray's answer was, well, what the hell are you letting the feet get out of place for in the first place?
Yeah, yeah. See, those are things that really set – you have to be pretty serious about horsemanship.
Yes.
To take something like that and be willing to cogitate on it to find, you know, the value in it.
Yes.
I think a lot of people just go, I have no idea what he just said. I've got
right.
a problem here. You know?
Craig says,
and
I'm still looking for the sailboat.
Yeah, and that's why I think there is a place for horsemen who direct their teaching to newbies,
yes,
who don't have the patience or the time or whatever to be really serious horse people. They need to be safe. They need to enjoy their time, and their horses need to be, you know, protected too. So I think that if we can help them by breaking it down and not being as obtuse as some of those things were,
mm-hmm,
or as impatient, mm-hmm, with them, which I think Ray was a little impatient with people
I
who didn't have the answer.
He could get there. Yeah, he could get there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we all can, for sure, at times. So, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. So you've written a number of books now. And I want to make sure we're not, we've got a couple minutes left here, but we're winding down pretty fast. So talk to us really quickly about the books that you've written and co-written and how folks can find those.
Yeah. Well, all of them are available, I think, online through booksellers, and you'd probably be finding, used copies of them. I don't think any of them are still in print, but the first one was The Revolution in Horsemanship and What It Means to Mankind.
Yes.
And I did that with Dr. Robert Miller. Thank you. Documented the whole natural horsemanship phenomenon, the people, the history, the science. The second one I did was a collection of short little essays. Actually, they were 1-minute radio shows that I put in script form. Called Horse Smarts for the Busy Rider, and that was really my first experimenting with micro-learning in a text form. And then the third one was just my personal story, and it's called Human to Horseman.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Awesome. And so folks out there listening, you can definitely do a Google search for those, and surely you will find
them. What they should probably do, Patrick, is just contact me, and I'll help them. I've got some available, and I can help them find them if they want it once.
Perfect. Yeah. So that's our next question then. How can folks get in touch with you?
It's pretty easy. RickLamb.com is the website.
Perfect.
And that really focuses on my micro-learning work. But if you scroll down to the very bottom, there's what we call legacy media. And it talks about the horse show and my books and has all the information there for contacting me.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay. And then one little surprise that I always put in. Every time I do a video or an audio, I have a question of the day at the end of it. And that's for folks to, it's where I ask a question of folks and they get the opportunity to answer those questions in the comment section of the video or of the audio. So I'm going to put that out there for you. You get to ask the question of the day.
Oh, and this is for people that are listening to this.
Yeah, this will be for our listeners. Yep.
Okay, this is just purely off the top of my head.
Perfect.
What do you want most out of your experience with your horse?
Ooh, I love it. I love it. You heard it, gang. What do you want most out of your experience with your horse? Rick, thank you so much for joining me for this. This has been an absolute blast.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you so much. Gang, I want to thank you for tuning in for episode number 9 of Talking About Horses. I really appreciate you giving Rick and I your ear. Please remember that if you've missed any of it, you can access the full broadcast through Facebook, through YouTube, or here in a couple days, streaming from iTunes. Through whatever outlet you're listening, please be sure to give us a rating, a comment, a review, or a share, or all of those. Your word of mouth is the fuel for this fire, that's for sure. Tune in next week for my interview with dressage trainer Karen Rolfe.